And I'm going to change the subject. Last time you saw me as making some basic models, not of ecology, but of neutral models in ecology. Now I will switch to some subject which Sylvia began this morning, which is about the... Do you hear me correctly, or it's, there is some kind of echo? No? Sylvia began the subject this morning with the emergence of cooperative behavior. So part of the talk I'm giving will be redundant with what Sylvia said, but the point I want to make here, it's just we have made all of these mathematical models about how we can solve the paradox of the cooperation and the fact that freeloaders or non-cooperators have a better fitness. And the point I want to make here is that maybe if we go back to the basic mathematics of the evolution, there is no paradox. So this is what I'm coming to in the next few slides. Again, all of us speak about evolution. I'm not sure that we always use the same words for what we are saying, so I'll take a little time to go through the basic fact of evolution as I understand it, and then I follow on why the paradox doesn't... I mean, it's not. I'm not saying that what I'm going to show you is going to explain everything about the cooperation of evolution. I'm more in the opinion of Jacques that we cannot look for universal laws in evolution or in biology. And as Jacob said many years ago, that evolution is mostly tinkering. So what I'm going to say here is not that I'm going to explain the cooperation. Maybe what I'm going to explain is that maybe there is no paradox in the evolution of cooperation. Okay, so this is talk. The outline of my talk is, as I said, I'm going to go back to how we understand Darwinian evolution and population genetics. And then I come to this very important fact, which all we know about, which is called genetic drift. We all know about, but I have sometimes the impression that this is considered some kind of parasitic or some kind of minor effect. So I want just to come back to genetic drift, what is genetic drift, and then I follow up to the paradox of altruism and why this paradox is maybe not a paradox. Okay, so again, let's come back to the evolution, and in my opinion, this picture captures what evolution, at least at the short term, is. You have these two guys running away from the tiger, but this guy realizes that they cannot run faster than the tiger, and he informs his friend that they cannot run faster than the tiger. So the friend answers that his aim is not to run faster than the tiger, his aim is to just run faster than the first guy. So the first point here is that fitness is relative. You are not just adapted, you are just slightly better adapted than the other individuals around you. You have just a better fitness. Fitness is relative, and this is one main point. The second point of this cartoon is that it's not because this guy is running 1 millimeter per hour faster than this guy that he's going to escape the tiger. Maybe the tiger cannot distinguish. If the difference in the speed between these two guys is too small, the tiger is not going to distinguish that one is running faster than the other. And or maybe by running, as very often Paul says, stuff happens, he falls down, and then tiger grabs this guy. So it's not because you have a better fitness that you are going to win. Much of stuff can happen in the middle, and this is why the evolutionary theory has to be captured in a probabilistic way. And this is what I'm coming to. So let's go back to the evolution theory of evolution. You all know that evolution began with these two guys. They went around the world, they looked at the patterns, and then they came with this nice theory of evolution that the individuals have always variability in some traits, and the other fact is each generation produces much more progeny that the community can accept. So there is a filtering process at this step, and some individuals which have some traits will have a better chance of getting the progeny to the next generation. The word chance wasn't formulated, of course, by these guys. I'm putting it here, but that's the only thing. If you pass more progeny to the next generation than your colleagues, then you have a better fitness. And okay, so the other fact which wasn't clear, they stated that the phenotype Z of individual is transmitted to the next generation. They had no idea of exactly how this phenotype is transmitted, and they also added some level of creation of variability through, at this time they wouldn't call it mutations, but they had some mechanism of creating variability at each step. The next big step in evolutionary theory came with Mendel, even though himself wasn't interested in evolution, he was just trying to discover the rules of heritation. But he made a huge discovery that the information you transmit to your progeny is quantified. Now we call that gene. The paper was forgotten for 40 years, and Mahadevan was telling the beautiful story of genetics. And it was rediscovered at the same time, and this is, as Mahadevan said, this is a nice coincidence, at the same time that physicists were discovering that there is some quantification for some quantity. And this was rediscovered at the same time. There are much coincidences between, if you go in population genetics and physics. I'll come to that maybe a little later as we go through this fact. So the very fact is the information transmitted to your downstream is quantified, and that saved the evolutionary theory. The most devastating attack on the evolutionary theory was made by Jenkins. At the time of Darwin, they were thinking in terms of blending theory, and Jenkins showed that if you use just the blending theory of heredity, then no mutation can win, because as soon as you transmit your trait to the downstream, to your progeny, the trait is diluted. This saved the day, so this is why the evolutionary theory became really a theory, and this is why we know that blue eyes are not getting diluted to become brown eyes by step. So, then we had this putting together of the Mendelian theory and the evolutionary theory, which got many names, for example, new synthesis, about how a gene changes its frequency. So the first kind of approach was purely deterministic. And the suppose that the P is the number of individuals, the proportional individuals, who have some slight beneficial advantage, some fitness, which I call S. Then this equation you already saw in the talk of Sylvia. The proportion of these individuals is going to increase during time by a very deterministic equation. P1 minus P is just, as you see, is always positive. So if S is positive, the population carrying this beneficial mutation is always going to spread. So that was the way many people around 1910, 1920 were thinking about evolution, deterministic evolution. But then, the modern population genetics theory was made, and the answer was we shouldn't approach evolution, as I said, with deterministic equations. You have to take into account the probabilities. So the guy who did that are these three guys, Fisher, Wright, and Haldane, and they made the stochastic evolution of the stochastic game of the evolution. And they stated that the precise statements come from this time that advantageous mutation has only a better probability to spread. It doesn't spread always, it has only a probability to spread. So the first nice model of this stochastic game was made by Fisher and Wright, and it's now called the Fisher and Wright model. And it's very close to what we look at in physics. Suppose that you have a particle, it's submitted to gravity, and it's also submitted to random motion, for example, because of the thermal motion. And we will call success if the particles from here get to here. We know that if gravity is very, very large compared to the thermal motion, that you can just use the usual Newtonian mechanics, and you know that by after some time these particles will get here, certainly. On the other hand, if the gravity is small compared to thermal motion, then this guy is mainly moving randomly, and the chances of getting here are small compared to the chances of getting elsewhere. So the same concept, which is very familiar to us in physics, was formulated in the same way by Fisher and Wright, you have just to make an analogy between what is thermal motion, what is the deterministic driving force. So you can very, very nicely understand that directly with the Fish and Wright model. Let me just take a few minutes to go through this model, because I mean all the basic facts I'm going to explain about are contained in this picture. So again, I'm just taking the basic statement of Darwin, Wallace, and Mendel. You have these various individuals. The size of the population is fixed. You cannot have more than n individuals in your community because of resource limitations. But each individual is producing much more progeny. This is the progeny I show here. And then you take, for the moment, I'm not taking any advantage or any beneficial mutations in this one. All these individuals are similar in their trait. And so in order to get this progeny, you just randomly choose among this progeny and make up the next generation. So what you see is that by pure chance, this individual green, for example, may have two progeny in the next generation, and the individual, I don't know what the color is, purple, bad luck, has no progeny in the next generation. The very simple game. You continue this game from generation to generation, and what you see is that after some generation, everybody will have the same color. I mean, I put them in green, but it could be any of them. But what happens is that after some point, we have no mutations here. We have just random evolution of the dynamics. After some time, everybody would have the same color. And if you reach this state, then you will always stay green. If every individual is green, of course, all the progeny will be green, and the next generation will be green. This is called a fixation, when one of the alleles, one of the individual, become the total majority and take everything in the population. And we know that this will happen. It's certain that the fixation will happen, but the probability that the fixation will happen with the green individual, as I said, all of these individuals are similar. So the probability that the fixation will happen with the green individuals, or with this one, are all equal. So the probability that the green ones get to the fixation is just 1 over n, where n is the size of population. Okay. Once this is clear, you can now add whatever you want to the model. For example, you can add advantageous mutation and say, for example, the green individual has a slightly better fitness, slightly better chance of having more progeny in the next generation. Or you can add mutations, you can add migrations, whatever you want. Now you have a nice stochastic model you can play with as a framework for thinking about how evolution proceeds. Okay, but there is a model slightly simpler in a mathematical term than the Fisher and Wright model. You can more easily compute stuff in it, and this is called the Moran model. And you heard me speaking about this model last time, even though ecologists didn't know that this is called the Moran model, so they put other names on it. But this is a model which was invented by Moran in the 60s. So it's the same model. Now you have the size of your population is fixed at some time. This is continuous time model. By chance, one individual will die, and as soon as this individual dies, it's going replaced by the progeny of another one, for example, the green one. And this is pure random again. And so you continue with this game. Somebody dies, it's replaced by somebody else. This model is totally equivalent in all of the aspects to the Fish and Wright model. It's what in stochastic we call a one-step model instead of multi-step models. But in all aspects, whatever you look at, the fixation time, fixation probability, everything, these models are similar. The only advantage of this model is that it's much nicer to handle mathematically. So, if you look, for example, at the number of green individuals, as I said, this is a stochastic game. Sometimes this number can go up, sometimes it can go down. If the number of individuals touches zero, the green individual disappears, the game is finished, for game over for this individual. I mean, you have no spontaneous generation. So if green individuals disappear, they are just done. But by some chance, this individual can get to the number of n, and this is called fixation, as I said. And if the individuals get to this state, after that, every individual will remain green. Okay. So now you can add to this model very nicely the advantage. You have now one allele which is slightly advantageous, And if we play this game, the probability for say for example, the green ones are slightly advantageous. So the probability for the number of the green individuals, if the number at some point is n, small n, the probability for them to decrease by one is that one green individual dies and it's replaced by one non-green individual. On the other hand, the probability for these green individuals to increase their number is the probability that one non-green individual dies, and then they are replaced by a green individuals, and this 1 plus s is just this advantage we put in the green individuals. So this is the fitness of these green individuals, and now you can compute everything. You can put that, you know, what we call a master equations. You can compute the probability of having n individuals at time t, and so on. This is classical mathematics, but what is nice, in fact, you can also compute directly the fixation probability. So the fixation probability, this is what we are going to use a lot here. I call it also pi. This is not the same pi that Sylvia was speaking about. Pi of k is the probability for a given genotype, beginning with k copies, to invade the community and get fixed and become n. So this fixation probability, it's again, if you know the transition rate, it's a nice linear system. It's not because it's linear that you can solve it, but it's a nice linear system. And in fact, for the one-step processes of the Moran processes, then you can compute it exactly. And the answer is something like that. Call C the cost, the reverse of the fitness, and then you have this very nice formula that shows you that the probability of fixation beginning with k individual is this formula. Okay, some formula. But if we are just, we can simplify this formula if we only look at small fitness, and this is what mainly we are looking at in evolution, small fitness. You don't, I mean, this is again discussed. But I believe that mutations which appear only confer small advantage. It's hard to make a mutation which confers to your big advantage. So if you consider the case when this S is small, and S, when I say n small, is that the product of the population number by the relative fitness is small compared to 1. Ns, by the way, is called the selection pressure. Then you have a nice formula for the fixation probability beginning with 1 copy. So again, we have this 1 over n term, but now you have a slightly higher probability of getting fixed if S is positive than the average. It means that you don't win, you have only a slightly better chance of winning than a purely neutral allele. And what you can see also here is when you get a deleterious mutation, if S is negative, you still have a chance of winning. It's not just because you're slightly deleterious that you're done. If the population size is finite, then even at small, then a deleterious mutation can get fixed. So now we have all the equivalent of the driving force. The gravity for us would be the fitness, and the thermal noise, the random noise, the genetic drift is this term 1 over n. Okay. So now we have everything in hand, and let me come back, now that we are clear about this fixation probability, get back to this paradox of altruism. I get back to my picture, to my cartoon, that he's telling the other guys that he only wants to learn faster than him. And the answer of this guy is, okay, go ahead, I'll try to divert the tiger, and you'll see, I may have a better probability of spreading my genes than you. So this is why it seems always so paradoxical to everybody that it's sure that this guy, I mean, he's mad. I mean, by just doing that, he's giving up all of his chances of spending his gene. So this is the paradox of altruism Sylvia was speaking about. And this is why we have gone to all of these mathematical models to explain why cooperation can exist. What I'm going to say in a few minutes is that maybe this behavior is not that paradoxical if you just look at the basic mathematics. But let's go to the, so I'm not going to redo the job of Sylvia. I want just to briefly resume what Sylvia said. First of all, a word of use. So what I'm going here to speak about is just the politically correct term. The title was Emergence of Common Good Producer and so on. Because as we had many discussions over the beers with Paul and with Jack, these terms, when we say altruism, are very, very loaded. When we say altruism, we immediately are thinking about ourselves, this moral behavior. Saint, I don't know which saint, gave his dress to a nude guy, or this kind of behavior. So in general, when you use these kind of terms, you have two reactions. What is the anti-anthropomorphist people who says that these kind of behaviors, altruism, are unique to humans. When we speak about other species, we shouldn't use the same terms. The other objection which was made, for example, much often by Paul, is that these terms are very loaded, and if we use them, we are trapping ourselves in some kind of thinking. So better to avoid it. My point is slightly different, is that, of course, and again, I'm going to cite the book of sociobiology by Wilson, that we are just nothing unique. It's like the Earth is not the center of the universe. Whatever we are the product of evolution, which is working the same way for the others. So there is no reason to think ourselves so superior or so unique. And whatever you observe in ourselves, maybe we have the right to give the same name to the others. And again, if we give precise mathematical definitions to what we mean by this term, then there is no problem. In mathematics, we have something called group theory, and nobody is shocked when you say group theory. Group theory is you have a set of objects, and you have a composition rules for them with some associative rules and so on. And so, group theory is a basic of mathematics. Nobody is shocked because we can define exactly what we mean, for example, by groups or by composition rules and so on. So, I'm not afraid of using these terms, altruism, because it's a shortcut instead of common good producers and non-common good producers and so on. So, I'm going to, yeah, please.
Do you make a difference? I agree with you that if you define it properly and you say, from now on, I define altruism like this, then we can adhere to the measurable definition and forget about the human connotation of moral. I don't agree that humans are the same as bacteria. There are differences which is the capability to choose on a projection of the future. So, but this is a big debate. But my question, no, it's really a question for clarification.
But would you suppose that humans are different from monkeys?
We can discuss later. This would divert us. My question is really for understanding. Because in sociobiology, there is a strong difference between different types of cooperativeness, and one of them is mutualism, and the other one is altruism. The way you just phrased altruism is not the strong definition of altruism, which implies
so this
just for the actor and a benefit for the
so you're right. So now, of course, I'm going to define precisely what I mean by altruism. And I cited this book. I don't know why this book is controversial. What I liked about this book is that it goes through the different behaviors and look how these behaviors can appear in different kind of organism. Then Wilson put on top of that other explanation. But what, in my opinion, was very nice in the Wilson book is just to go through all of the, not all of them, some behaviors and see how these behaviors are in this species or this species and this species. And this is what I liked about the book. I'm not going to any of the controversy of Wilson speaking about kin selection or not kin selection or so on. So, this is the definition of altruism or the common good producer I'm going to use. This is an individual which is producing a common good which benefits anybody, everybody in the community. And producing this common good has a cost to this individual. The producing of common good is increasing the fitness of everybody. The producing of common good is decreasing the fitness of the individual. So, again, let's speak about fitness. What do you mean by fitness? This is the only measurable quantity we can use it. It's how many individuals you are getting to the next generation. And this is the only definition of fitness I'm going to use. So this is a perfectly measurable quantity.
Progeny or related individuals?
I mean, how many surviving progeny able to reproduce themselves you pass to the next generation?
So it doesn't have to be progeny.
No, okay. Here I'm speaking about progeny, but you are thinking about other kind of increasing the population?
Like cousins or...
Okay, no, here I'm just speaking about progeny. So, again, Sylvia gave many examples, and these examples were discussed by many people that are not truly relevant about how altruism is widespread. But let's stick to the point, because that We have widespread altruism in the sense I've defined in microbial world. For example, something we have a lot of discussion about is Dictyostelium, where some individuals, or 20% of individuals, during the aggregation phase, go to the stalk phase and give up their chance to make a progeny. You have a nice example here. This is an octopus in this warm water of Hawaii. And the squid has a kind of third eye. In this third eye, it grows bacteria, a bacteria called Vibrio fischeri. And the job of this bacteria is to produce light. So they produce light, and in exchange, the squid gives them some nutrients. Nobody knows exactly which kind of benefit the squid takes from this bacteria, but this is a very nice system where this bacteria grow inside its third eyes. They produce light. This is the common good they produce, and in exchange of the light, they get some nutrients. And of course, nutrient is distributed to all individuals, so if one individual is not producing light, it's a non... Yes, please. So this is a symbiosis, but from my point of view, I'm just interested in the bacteria, not so much in the squid. Please.
The first example I don't understand. How can you tell altruistic behavior from, you know, just 20% of them dying when they aggregate?
So you know that there is a cost to go to the stalk phase and give up your chance. You go to stalk phase, so you allow the others to make sporulation, and for yourself, the cost is infinite because you are not going to produce any progeny. Again, if you stick to the strict definition I'm giving, I don't think I'm crossing the red line. Please.
Do you mean what was the question?
I
didn't
understand.
I
have to understand the question.
I'm wondering if you're talking about weak or strong altruism. So is the producer's share of the public good allowed to be bigger than the cost of producing?
For the moment, I have no such a kind of idea. So we will get to kin selection, group selection, cost and benefit slightly later. But I just want to avoid, I mean, my whole point is just first look if we have paradoxes and then see if we can put benefits, cost and so on. So these are examples just to motivate, and of course these examples are not any more good because Sylvia gave this nice talk and went through some of the examples. So just take this as a motivation, so you know that, for example, Pseudomonas is producing some enzyme, C04 production is just to digest the iron, and it's spreading that in the community, and all of these kind of examples people can think about. So we can think that if you're making an enzyme and giving it to everybody, this has a cost to your own growth. So now the altruism paradox. So this is what Sylvia was thinking about, so this is what's known to everybody. If you have a non-cooperator, which I call S, and S is growing with A, then S has a better growth rate or anything and uses the A to get just bigger and bigger. So in order to solve this paradox, people made two kind of theories. First, let's come back just to see what this is an important point, why we have this paradox. So if one individual has a cost in producing the common good, then its fitness is negative, then the rate of variation of this frequency in the population is negative. P1 minus P is always positive, this term is negative, so the rate of change of the frequency of the gene is negative, so the number of these people is going down. This is what you would do if you just write the deterministic model, the mean field model. So when, of course, people looking at this equation would say that, okay, so altruism doesn't exist. If we see altruism around us, it's because altruism has some benefits which we hadn't taken into account. And now if we take into account and we renormalize the fitness, then everything gets okay and this term may become positive. So the whole part of this different theory is how to make this term positive by considering kin selection or group selections or these kind of things.
Sorry, I have a problem there. I don't know whether you should address it now, but let me mention it. You reach an empirical conclusion saying that altruism doesn't exist on the basis of a mathematical equation which is heavily loaded. It's not clear what its relation is to the
other. I'm just putting in mathematical terms this picture, that if we consider only the basic fact that the freeloaders, the selfish ones, don't produce the common good, but they use the common good produced by the other, they have a better fitness. So I'm just, again, coming back to the population dynamics models. If you have two alleles, one with the fitness, one what the fitness is, this is the rate of evolution of your frequency of the alleles. I'm not doing nothing else than put that in just into mathematical terms. So, okay, so the first kind of theory you hear a lot about, it was first formulated by Wright, verbally, without mathematics. Wright said that he would jump in a river to save two brothers or four cousins or eight cousins of cousins. This argument was verbally formulated, then Hamilton built upon that, the kin selection. The kin selection. Sorry? That was Halden, okay, sorry. Sorry, thank you for correcting me. And again, the argument of, I don't want to go to, it's not my business to go to the kin selection, but the argument is that if you have more of your kind around which can give you some benefits, then your fitness can become positive. Hamilton did that in the context of diploid organism, but you can make the same kind of argument in the context of haploid organisms, which is much easier to understand. The paper of Hamilton, I find it hard to read because he's inventing a lot of mathematical notation by himself. But anyway, the facts are very simple. This is what I said. If you just take negative fitness, the rate of change of your population is always negative. And this is what Sylvia was showing in his slide. And the stable point is always the point when your population, the altruistic population disappears. On the other hand, if the fitness term is frequency dependent, if you have a lot of your kind around and they all contribute to your benefits and not to the benefits of the other, then the fitness term is frequency dependent. It also depends on P, it can have different shape, and then the altruist can become stable, and you can make that, of course, into stochastic terms. There are hundreds of papers using this kind of model to explain the appearance of altruism with kin selection. So kin selection has its own problem. You know that there is a huge debate going around. For example, that of course, if you want to help only your kin, you have to have a mechanism to recognize your kin. So which one evolved first? And the same thing, if you don't make rewards, you add punishment. That was discussed. I don't remember by whom. And of course, what if suddenly your brother decides to cheat on you? You will help your brother. He's not going to help you. Your brother becomes a defector. So we are coming back to the first argument. So these arguments are much debated. I really don't want to go into it because it's not my point. I wanted just to recall this kind of argument. But as you know, and I think Ellen mentioned this paper, very recently, again, there was this paper by Novak and Wilson, and of course, what is nice is not that this paper, I don't know so much, I mean, you read it, so but the kind of debate this paper provoked. I mean, the next week you had four replies, the week after you had 500 replies, and the day after you had billions of replies and people replying to each other, and this is a kind of wild, wild west, like people insulting each other, stupid ones, and so on. This is something which is strange for me, is why people put so much emotion in their theories. I mean, it's, from a sociologic point of view, this paper was incredibly incredibly nice, the way people addressed each other. Okay, now let's come to the group selection theory. As you know, many people thought in terms of group theory. I mean, that was nothing bad in the old time. These good people, Dobzhansky and Meyer, would really very easily use group theoretical arguments. And then, as Ellen mentioned, there was this argument by Williams that because of this paradox of the freeloaders, group selection cannot exist. So this was a very influential book and kind of excommunicated group selection. For sometimes, if you would speak about group selection, you would just the stupidest guy speaking like Lamarck. I mean, Lamarck and group selection were put on the same beholding. But then, by small steps, group selections, it's really happened to me that I wrote a paper which had nothing to do with evolution. And in the introduction, I was just putting some sentence, and the referee thought that I'm using group selection. And he just didn't read the paper. He treated me as the most stupidest guy, how I dared to submit a paper, and just he rejected my paper. So we had a kind of argument. But when I speak about excommunication, I really mean excommunication. So, as you know, that at least in the evolutionary, in the normal evolutionary people, the group selection was restored by many people. Lewontin wrote a very nice paper, and then, of course, there was the price equation, which kind of restored the confidence people can have in the group selection theory. And the argument is nice, the price is very simple. Sylvia went through it, is that even though in each group, the number of altruists is going to go down. In some cases, if there is some covariance between the fitness and the proportion of the altruists in this group is positive, it can compensate for this negative term, so the average number of altruists is going. This is a very basic statement. You just say that you take these kind of groups, each group increases its size, somehow proportional, or doesn't matter if it's proportional or any kind of non-linearity, to the number of altruists it has, then after some time, different groups grow at different rates. So if you compute that, and this is called the Simpson paradox, Sylvia was pointing to, the average number of altruists can grow. This is the average, but this, of course, cannot go on and on. In each group, the altruists are going down. So if you want to make this mechanism stable, you need a mixing mechanism somehow. And somehow you take all the groups, you mix them, and again you separated them. And this is what one of the model Sylvia was referring to. So this model has this simple model of as many futures. One of the futures that, I'm so sorry I use this term, please don't excommunicate me. Cheaters only means the people who don't contribute in this very precise mathematical way I'm speaking about. So if you want to avoid this mixing mechanism, you can really put by hand the group selections. You can make trials, and this has been done, for example, partially again by Novak recently, or 4 years ago. But now there is kind of sometimes they come to when you want to be in the community, kind of satisfying everybody, you would say that, okay, we have all of these different way of making the altruism to emerge. The first one is the kin selection I was speaking about, the last one is the group selection I was speaking about, and then you have many variations in between you can make out. Okay. So now I come to my point. Let's go back to the mathematics, and let's see if really there is a paradox. I mean, until now, I was mainly speaking in deterministic terms. Let's get back to the individual level, and the fact that it's not because you have a better fitness that you are going to win. Again, the most important quantity you have to speak about is the fixation probability. The probability that after some time, it is you who invade the community and not the other guy. The fixation probability and not the fitness. Okay. So what I want to make is just try to avoid. Again, I'm not saying that the other models are wrong or something. I mean, there are many different kind of behaviors you can observe in nature, and I'm sure, even though there is a war between these different communities, that you would at sometimes use one of these arguments to explain the cooperative behavior for this community or this community. What I'm going to say that, coming back to the first point, maybe we don't need to solve a paradox. So what I want to present you is that now, I want to present you a model which keeps the very simplicity of the original Fisher and Wright model. Not so many parameters. Fisher and Wright model had only two parameters, which are very nice: the size of the population and the fitness. Both are measurable in principle, and it's a very generic model. You know that now the noise term, the stochastic term, is associated to this 1 over n, the size of the population, and the driving force is related to the fitness, to the excess fitness, relative fitness, 1 plus s. So what I want to present to you is a model which has nearly the same simplicity. And it doesn't involve, of course, any kind of recognition mechanism or multi-level selections. And what I like very much is I want to stay at the level, I know that again has been much discussed, I want to stay at the level of selection, at the level of individuals, no groups, and so on. So these are the kind of thing I want to put inside the model, but let's see what I mean by that. So again, the important quantity is the fixation probability and not the fitness. This is the fact which, in my opinion, has been very, very often forgotten. So consider now what we mean by common good producer. Suppose that you have two kind of individuals, S and A. Okay, S is for selfish, of course. A is for altruism, altruist. And it's funny that both Sylvia and me use the same colors for altruist, red, and blue for S. I don't know if it's just a coincidence, it's a psychological bias or something, but anyway. So what I'm going to suppose that altruists produce a common good which allow the size of the community to be larger. So if you have only altruists in the community, the size of your community is NF. And if you have no altruists in the community, if you have only selfish one, the size of the community is ZI. And then in between, if you have a mixed population, the size of population is somehow in the middle. At each time, I have to insist on that, at each time you compare selfish to altruists, selfish have a better fitness than altruists. Now let's come back to, so I'm not making any kind of frequency dependent or so on. Selfish are always have a better fitness. So the question is, do they have a better fixation probability? So to address this question, you just make again, you take into account the change in the population size. Now you make the same kind of stochastic model Fisher and Wright were making, but then you allow the size of the population to vary between NI and NF. So this is a stochastic process. The size of the population can vary at E during a short time. DT can vary by one step. And the probability that the size of the population increases depends on the number of the altruists present. But when this population increases its size, there is a more probability that this new individual is a selfish individual than an altruist individual. Even though the size of the increase in the size of the population depends on the number of altruists, when a new individual appears in the community, then it has a better chance of being altruist than selfish. So the altruist one have a fitness of minus S, the selfish one has a fitness of plus S, and then you can make an analog process for the coming down of the number of populations. You also know that the size of the population can decrease, and you make some very symmetric argument on that. So this is the only thing I take into account. And now let's look at the fixation probability. So before going to the math, and I don't want to get to the mathematical how we solve that, but the basic argument is what you call a back of the envelope computation. Suppose that you have a community made only of selfish individuals, and you introduce in this community one altruistic individual. And you can ask, what's the probability for this altruistic individual to win over and then to make the whole population become altruistic? So based on what I said before, Fisher and Wright model or the Moran model, you know, again, we are thinking in terms of small selective advantage or cost. So the probability for the altruistic individual to get fixed is exactly what I said, is 1 over Ni minus S over 2. This is because it has a deleterious, if you can think of, it has a negative fitness. Now you can ask the same question, what's the cost of introducing one selfish individual in a community of altruists? And again, the same argument, the priority of fixation of the selfish when it's introduced in an altruistic community, and at the end you have only selfish ones, based on what I said is 1 over NF, which was the size of the population you introduced into, plus S. Now you can ask, okay, the fitness of the selfish one is always bigger than the fitness of the altruistic one, but is their fixation probability bigger? And you can see immediately based on this argument that if the fitness is smaller than the difference, the relative difference in the number of individuals, the number of size of the communities, then indeed the fixation probability of altruists is bigger than the fixation probability of selfish one. And you have nothing else to add here. The only thing you need is that the size of the community the difference in the size of the community can be enough to compensate for the fitness disadvantage of the altruistic ones. This is a pure stochastic effect. There is no hidden benefits or so on. The only thing is that when you introduce a mutant allele in a community, the mutant has to fight the genetic drift. And the genetic drift of a selfish one introduced into community of altruistic one is just bigger, just pure demographic effect and stochastic effect. So it's not, again, I insist, it's not only the fitness you have to consider, you have to consider the whole picture. The whole picture has to take into account the genetic drift, and the genetic drift is higher for the selfish ones just because of demographic effect. So now if you take, in terms of, you have many of different communities isolated from each other, you have mutation from altruistic to selfish one, mutations are rare, you are observing this community, then for example, some one altruistic mutations appear here, then after some time, there is a chance that the whole community becomes A. And then you let the system go on in time, and maybe there is a selfish individual appearing here, this community disappears, but maybe another one get fixed with the altruistic one. And if you continue that, because the fixation priority of the altruistic one is higher, at the end, you have most of the communities get to the altruistic state and not to the selfish state. Okay, please, Sylvia. Because I presented to you just... The question of Celia was why the fixation priority should only depend on the initial size of the population. This is a huge, a whole dynamic game, and it's a huge simplification to take only the initial size of the population for computing the fixation of priorities. And you're absolutely right. This was only a back of the envelope computation just to show you, and I'm going to present to you now the whole computation. But the whole picture is captured just in this back of the envelope computation. Of course, now you can do numerical simulations on that. This is just stochastic numerical simulation. You take your Gillespie array algorithm, you do that. And you can make, of course, the whole analytical computation. So let me slightly speak about the analytical computation just to convince you that I'm not scamming you, and this has a very robust mathematical backing. So I'm just going to put into mathematics whatever I say. The first two lines, so these are the transition rates, for example, for the number of cheaters to be increased by one, or for the number of the, sorry, for the word cheaters again, for the non-cooperators or non-common good producer. So the M is the number of selfish ones, N is the number of the altruistic ones. The first two lines is the probability for the size of the population to increase by one, and when the size of the population has increased by one, it has a priority to become a selfish one or altruistic one. The last two ones are exactly the similar process for the size of the population to go down, and when somebody dies, it has some priority to be the selfish guy or the altruistic guy, and now we add here that the altruistic guy has a cost, so we put a C here, which is the cost to the altruism. But again, this process is totally symmetric, except that we have put a cost on the altruistic one, and no frequency dependent, no group, no genes, nothing.
What used to be your mu?
Sorry?
The alpha? That was mu?
Well, I guess, I have changed, you're right. I changed my notations in the middle. You're right. Sorry. Can you repeat your question? So Ni is the size of the population. So okay, the question was, what are the Ni and NF? Ni is the size of the community if you have only selfish individuals, and NF is the size of the community if the community was composed only of altruistic ones. So the population can never get higher than NF, it can get never lower than Ni, and in general it's moving randomly in between two bounds, but again, if the number of selfish go to zero, then everybody is in the, altruistic, and the total number of population will go to NF. On the other hand, if by chance the number of altruists go to zero, then the total size of population will go to NS. It's just a basic stochastic processes But now you have two components instead of having one component, selfish and altruistic. So here what you see, NF and AI, is just that these two terms are exactly like the Fisher model, just to take the size of the equation fixed. Here we don't take it fixed, we take the size of the equation as varying between two bounds. But these two terms are exactly what you have in the Moran model, for example. Okay, so as soon as you state your transition rates, which is just a way of putting mathematically what I said, nothing more, then you can compute the fixation probabilities, and this is what I teach in my lectures on stochastic processes. If you have your rates, then you can write an equation for the fixation probability, beginning with n copies of selfish one and n copies of altruistic one. So you have a nice equation for that. The equations in discrete are always not, you cannot solve them always. So you have a very nice approximation for that called diffusion approximation. And you transform the other equation to this equation. This is an ugly elliptic equation. Doesn't matter how we solve it. These coefficients are all polynomials in the proportion of altruist and the proportion of selfish ones. But anyway, after some time, if you bang your head enough at the wall of this equation, you can solve it. And in fact, you have a very nice solution for that. You can now say that if I begin with the proportion mu of altruist, then the total size of the population is eta, relative size of the population compared to NF, then this is the solution, which, if you know a little about population genetics, this is a slight generalization of what, for example, was the Kimura solution to the spread of, as Kimura published his paper in 1964 or 1965. Kimura was the first one to give a kind of nice answer to the fish and dried model. So this is a slight generalization of the Kimura solution. And of course, once you have your equations, you have to compare it to numerical simulations. And of course, we have different kinds of numerical simulation. As I don't want to show, but the answer here we get is extremely good. We developed the answer for the small selection pressure, but you can go to very high selection pressure, and still this solution is good. Okay. So now, I come back to your question, Sylvia. Now, if we take everything into account, what's the probability of fixation of altruists if we introduce one copy of an altruist in a community of selfish mutants? And if you look at this answer, it's really close to what I said. I mean, you have many coefficients, but the main fact is here, again, you have your 1 over ni here, you have your s here, and this, if you look at it, it's nothing more than something like 1, or close to 1. It's just a numerical factor, a product, but this, you see, it's not that, if NI and NF are in the range of 100, it's not something difficult. And gamma is just a numerical factor you compute in your computation. So now the exact answer you get for the probability of fixations are very close to what I showed with the back of envelope computation. And now I hope that I convince you that really this is the fact. Even though the fitness of the selfish one is higher, the fixation probability can be lower if the increase in the size of the population is big enough for the genetic drift to compensate for the say cost to the altruism. So, and this is the main argument, if the selection pressure against the altruist, S is their relative cost, and F is the size of the population when it's high, if the selection pressure is smaller than the relative increase in the size of the population, then altruist fixation priority is higher. So when you see that, you would think this is close to the Hamilton argument. We have cost and benefits here, but there are none of these mechanisms. This is a pure stochastic effect. Has nothing to do with recognition or kin selection or so on. So and then again, this formula, you can check it with hundreds of numerical simulations. We know how to do that, and you see that again, this equilibrium selection pressure, it's indeed what is the predicted, is indeed what confirms to numerical simulation. That if you have a selection pressure which is smaller than that, then fixation probability of altruist is higher. Okay, so that's this part I showed you was the fixation.
10 minutes.
Oh, 50 minutes, huh?
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. No, I'm nearly finished. Please.
So maybe it's a kind of a stupid question, but...
I think Mahadevan said, and this is what I always say, there is no stupid question, please don't begin with that.
So, do you have any empirical or
experimental? No, my point here is just to show... So the question is, do we have any kind of empirical evidence that this model is valid? And I say no. Normally what I do in my life is first do the experiment and then write the model. So I haven't done any kind of experiment to show that. You weren't in my first lecture, but again, my only point is that maybe there is no paradox. I mean, we have built all of this mathematical stuff because we are thinking that there is a paradox. And my point is, first of all, let's think there is no paradox. Even pure stochastic effects can make the altruist behavior favorable. So at this time, you can take it just as a purely mathematical point.
So to follow up that question, so if one has to test this model, what parameters or what characteristics would it be?
So as you said, and this comes back to... So the question was, if we wanted to design a model, which kind of parameters do we have to measure? Did I, So as you saw in this model, we have nothing more than what was initially in the Fish and Rat model, the size of the population, the cost of the altruism, and the change in the size of the population when altruists are present. That's the three parameters we should think of. And for the moment, I haven't been able to design a microbial experiment to do that. I would be very happy to measure this kind of stuff. But again, if you wanted to do the experiment, this model has only three parameters, which are the size of the population, which I guess you could measure. Fitness, in principle, you could measure by counting in a statistical way the number of progeny getting to the next generation, and the change in the number of population, the size of the population. Okay, so now I was speaking about isolated community. Now let's take, put this community into space and allow them to exchange migrations, because as we all know, no community was the same. No man is an island. So no community is really isolated. So now this part of the competition I'm going to show you, it's not done analytically. So it's just, again, a back of envelope computation. Now suppose that I dispose different committees into space, and for the sake of argument, the right half of the space, this is a one-dimensional model, space is only, we have only committees of altruists, and on the left part of the space, you have only committee of selfish ones. And now you suppose that you have a migration rate between these committees. Each committee can send migrants to another one. What I'm supposing here now is that the migration rate is very, very small compared to the fixation time. Then you can make this argument very easily. Sometimes you have a selfish one jumping here and it has a priority to get fixed. Or sometimes you have a priority for one altruist to jump here and then to get fixed. So you can think of the movement of this boundary as a random movement, a Brownian movement toward left and right, which some kind of buoyance. So again, sorry, P plus is the other way and P minus is this way. So you can ask what's the priority for the boundary to go one way here or one way here. It's just the result of what I said before. It's just the ratio of these fixation probabilities times now the demographic effect. It means that the fixation probability we had before, now it's amplified because of demographic effects, and because when you have more populations, you send more migrants toward the other community. And in this regime, where the migration, again, I insist, this is a computation only valid for small migration rate, then in this case, you can show that, in fact, the fixation probability of one selfish one introduced in the community as a whole, this is zero. If the size of the community is big, the fixation probability of the cheaters, the selfish one, is zero, and this is part of the answer. How the system is stable against the non-cooperators. But of course, this argument doesn't hold if the migration rate is too high, then you have this kind of mixed population everywhere. The total size of your population is huge. So the selection pressure, the product of the total surge depression by the cost, now it's huge, it's infinite. And then in this regime, when you have high migration rate, then you know that in fact that's one regime where the altruist cannot win. So there is a threshold here. There is some migration rate which can favor altruistic ones and some migration rate which can favor the selfish ones. Okay, so this part, I'm developing all the mathematical tools to solve this again exactly, or at least as exactly as I did before. This is a work in progress, so maybe next year I could speak about it if VIDIA organizes some again nice conference like that. So let me just again summarize what I did in this talk. I mean, I wouldn't, maybe new theoretical is a bad word for that. I wanted just to show that emergence of altruism by itself shouldn't be that hard. I'm not saying that none of these other effects of behaving in groups and one doesn't exist, but this paradox of always beginning, oh, altruism has a big paradox, we have to solve it, this may be not a paradox. And for that, we only need to generalize the original Fish and Wright models and act only one demographic effect that the altruistic ones allow the size of the population to be bigger. There is no hidden benefits, no kin selection, no group selection in this model. And of course, the direction in which we want to advance is first to put space explicitly into this model and solve it. And some people pointed to that, really design a laboratory experiment to show that, I mean, again, this could happen even in real organism, and it's not just the sake of mathematics. Okay, I thank you very much.
What happens if you assume that this is not an inherited trait, but some behavior that is expressed at random with some probability at each time step?
So you mean that, for example, one individual can change its behavior from altruistic?
Yeah,
I don't know.
At random.
I don't know. This is just pure speculation, that if you don't put something to stabilize this switch somehow, you lose this argument. But again, I'm not sure. Pardon?
So this is dependent on spatial structure.
Sorry?
Dependent on spatial structure.
What do you mean by that?
That entities have a fixed relationship to one another. Or is this a well-made?
Why do I feel stupid?
I'm just wondering how... So it's a well-mixed population.
I mean, if the migration rate is high, I mean, yeah. The basic of argument was if the migration rate is low, when a migrant comes to this place, the time to get fixed is much smaller than the time for the next migrant to come in.
So they can. So anything can go anywhere. It's not spatially explicit. Well, it is spatially explicit.
No, this is as spatially explicit,
yeah,
because you have dispersal. I mean,
yeah,
you can make explicit dispersal of sending migrants to some distance or divide your space into yeah, rectangles and send. But this is spatially explicit. But the argument I'm giving here only holds if the migration rate is small. It means that a migration gets to this place, and then either it disappears or it gets fixed before another migrant comes in.
Okay.
So in this regime, the argument I was making is we are amplifying the effect, demographic effect I was speaking about.
Right.
And if no, we have these mixed bonds, and at the very high limit of migrations, the whole population can be considered as a zero-dimensional population,
yeah,
and then the selection pressure against the altruists is too high, it's infinite,
right,
so they cannot emerge.
So is there a connection here between Novak and so on's representation of selection on graphs? This is effectively what you're doing here.
So,
if
you want to ask me how I get here, my last work was effectively on the propagation of mutations on graphs.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm not sure that I could generalize the work we did on the spread on graphs to here. But that, I mean, I slightly tried. So, but yeah, I mean, if you want to make a model spatially explicit, you make one of these kind of models. Here it's much simpler. You only communicate with your next neighbor and not to other people in the connected graph.
Okay, thank you. And how dependent is it on birth, death versus death, birth in the Moran process implementation? Have you looked?
How the word was implemented, you mean?
Well, it often makes a big difference whether you have an organism dying and then being replaced or one giving birth and then dying. Right? The birth, death, death, birth.
Have you read my preceding paper or you're just asking a question?
Okay. this is.
So in fact, so if you forget about altruism,
yeah.
You are just speaking about the spread in a fixed size populations of graphs. I mean, you have this island, this island, this island, this line. The size of the population is fixed on this one, and the island can send migrants to this one. Usually, saying death first and birth next has no consequence. But if the graphs are not balanced, the number of migrants one island sends is smaller than the number of migrants it received, then it becomes crucially important.
Yeah.
For example, Novak and company made a paper saying that the fixation priority can get close to one. This is in the case when you have birth first and death after. And if you have only death first and birth after, the argument of Novak is not valid. So in fact, this is something surprising in a specially spread population, the birth-death and death-death is important.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sylvia? Thank you. Sorry, I'm not completely convinced that this is radically different from the Simpson's paradox case, in the sense that it looks to me that you have like a metapopulation with groups that are small, and in these groups, usually altruists have a higher payoff with respect to groups with the same proportion that are larger, and then basically you have a dependence of your group size on the proportion of what you have inside. That to me, if you go to the continuous limit, should lead to a fitness effect.
That's what I'm saying. If you go to a continuous limit, you're lost. The selection pressure is incredibly high. If that was the so, I'll come to your first argument. But this is the meaning here. If you go to continuous limit, where the size of the population is extremely high, then the selection pressure is extremely high. You can never reach this balance. Coming back to the Simpson paradox, we are not taking groups, and in the Simpson paradox, in each group you are looking at, the first model of it, the number of altruists is decreasing, and the Simpson paradox just, you know, and then you need a mixing mechanism just to restore it, and never you can get rid of cheaters, for example. This is not a deterministic model, it's just based on computing what's the priority to get fixed to take the whole community by continuous one community. No mixing, nothing in this middle.
So, thanks for the talk. It was very didactic with the historical emphasis and very consistent, because finally you come back to a model where you restore probability, you restore selection as a probability event, like Darwin already formulated. The interest of your model, if I understand well, is that as you said, simplicity. You don't assume. You don't have to assume relatedness. You don't have to assume hidden variables or the hand of selection and so on. So it's very simple, self-contained, and so on, and very elegant. I have one question though. Everything relies on the genetic tree, which I think it's very interesting idea to bring into this question. But genetic tree, typically, as you showed by the formula, depends on the size of the population. And so I understand that it can work in the simulations when you have small populations, but if you have big populations, will it still work? And in particular, when you consider microbial populations, then you have huge populations.
Okay. So indeed, this is an important point. So what is a big population? I mean, how do you define that the population is... How do you define that the population is big or no? And again, we go back to a very crucial point of the population genetics. What's the size of the population? And so you know that maybe you know that there is something called effective population size, which is something I hate, because I never saw a paper really showing that there is such a thing as the effective population size. Coming back to your question, the population is big. You have a huge box, you can consider big if one individual dies here, it can get replaced by everybody else. But in reality, when one body dies here, it can only get replaced by the people around it. So, in fact, the size of the population cannot be disconnected from the migration rate, the dispersal limit. This is what sets, indeed, spatially explicit models. You have to take into account how the migrants go to this side or the other. Because when your microbe dies here, for example, take Dictyostelium. If your Dictyostelium dies here, it can't get replaced by Dictyostelium, which is downstairs. And they got replaced only by the people in the neighborhood. So this is why I made this this part of making an explicitly spatially modeled, so the total size of the population here is huge. I suppose that you have infinitely many islands here, infinitely many islands here.
When you speak, do you make a distinction between, for instance, you have Roger and several Dictyostelium who are making different slimes. So what you call population is all the Dictyostelium that are in a reachable diameter, and then you call a group one slime. I mean, the boxes that you show there are not the population, these are the groups. Is it correct? What do you call a population?
So I try to avoid the term groups. I would think in terms of islands. I mean, this is what we call the island models.
Okay.
So island. The population is divided into islands, and islands send just migrants to each other.
So okay, my question was not then about the population size, but about the island size. Because the trick, you need to fix the allele within one island. So if one island is like in one colony of bacteria, 1 billion of individuals, or 1 million of individuals, and the probability of
zero. So this is why you have to take into account the migration rate. Because you cannot say at the beginning that this is the size of my island. The only thing which sets the size of your island is when this guy disappears, what's the priority of getting replaced by the people in the neighborhood? Then you take into account who are the people in the neighborhood who can replace you guys, and this sets basically the size of your island. So you cannot separate the size of island from the migration rate. I'm not clear.
Maybe we could discuss this point later.
I was impressed by this conclusion that you drew there, the probability of a cheater or altruistic to invade the community is zero. It's a related question. Have you established the number of let's say, of the majority in which this phenomenon happens? In other words, how many individuals are necessary for the cheater not to...
So, this I don't know, and this is the part of the models I'm continuing to make. Again, as I said, this crucially depends on how many... What's the migration rate? If you take per unit of time, how many people you receive from this side and how many people you receive from this side. This is gives you, in fact, the threshold for the altruist to emerge or not to emerge. And, for example, in this way, when you see, when you see that PS goes to zero, it's only based on this argument, that you combine the two fixation probabilities, the demographic effect and the fixation effect. But, again, this depends on how far you can send your seed or how far you can go and replace somebody else. This is really sets the migration rate and the size of the population are not independent quantities. So we have to do more work on that. For the moment, I was just presenting this zero-dimensional model and a slight generalization to the spatial models.
I just want to add that this has clear relationship to the issue of metastasis. The cell, a so-called cancer cell, can be normalized by the community around it, where it lands.
Okay. Thank you very much for the comment.
Great.
I waited right to the end because I'm going to talk about a comment that you made, which has got nothing to do with this, but this is the story of Vibrio fischeri, and you said we didn't know what the advantage was to the squid. But we do. And it's a beautiful story.
Oh, you are not going to speak about the shadows on the moon?
Not shadows on the moon, but the point is that when it's the Hawaiian bobtail squid, and it hunts in very shallow waters around Hawaii.
Yeah, so this is the expression very often I hear.
And why, what is wrong with it? Because it's a purely experimental observation.
This some people have measured that the shadow of the squid is completely smooth.
It never casts a shadow, that's the point. The third eye sits in the abdomen, it's got two flaps over it, and the bobtail squid can match the incident light with the light cast by this. Under dark conditions, the flaps are closed, and when it hunts on a moonlit night, then the flaps are open. Never casts a shadow, which of course is an advantage.
So this is the explanation I must hear from this squid. Maybe you could point me to some papers that people have really measured that making a shadow or not making a shadow makes a difference.
Well, I mean, no. Okay, so that extra point that it makes a difference is not measurable, I think. But I mean, it makes a nice story, that's why.
Yeah. This is what, yeah, you're right. That's make a nice story.
Just one point before we break up, this is addressed to all the speakers, and this is a point that I raised 2 days ago, but now that we have a full complement.